Echo Plus.
Hello and welcome to Echo Plus programme. My name's John Harrison. The RLC may be a long way away. Indeed, most people have never even heard of it. One reason for this is that it lies halfway between Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, both countries which are not exactly on the Western tourist hotspots. Indeed, we hardly ever hear about that part of the world. Be that as it may, the RLC, up till 50 years ago, was one of the world's largest four lakes, and it has an area of 25,500 square miles. To put this in perspective, this is roughly three times the size of Wales. Now, the RLC has, in the last 50 years, shrunk to a fraction of its former size, as we can clearly see by satellite pictures released by NASA, which have been splashed all over the world's press in the last few weeks for some reason. Now, what has happened to the RLC? Is there any chance that the sea can ever recover? What is the effect on local populations? Joining me to answer these questions and other related issues is Professor Peter Zavyalov, Deputy Director of the Institute of Oceanology at the Russian Academy of Sciences, and Professor Philip Micklin, retired from the Department of Geography at Western Michigan University. Thank both of you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Glad to.
Okay, if we can start off, please. I don't know who'd like to answer this the first question. What happened to the ROC briefly in a couple of minutes? Professor Zavyalov, would you like to start?
Okay, John. Well, the RLC has been desiccating steadily starting from 1960. And by now, as you correctly pointed out, it lost more than 90% of its volume. Mm. The main reason was, or is believed to have been, anthropogenic, which means anthropogenic diversions of water from the tributary rivers, which are Amudarya River and Sirdarya River. But we believe now that along with the anthropogenic causes, there were also some natural climate change impacts associated with warming and drying of the local climate.
Right. Okay. Well, that's something that wasn't in the Huffington Post news reports. I didn't know that there was a climatic change factor as well. Does that mean that if the climate change factors were to reverse, there's a chance that the sea may recover slightly? Perhaps you'd like to come in here, Professor Micklin.
I agree with Peter that the primary cause of the desiccation, the drying of the Aral Sea since 1960, has been human actions. The removal of water for irrigation, both in the basin of the Sirdarya and the basin of the Amudarya.
Is this damage, if we talk about it as being environmental damage, is this something that can be reversed, or is this a one-way journey? Can it ever be, if we were to, example, to change the courses of those two rivers back again to where they were before, could the sea potentially ever be restored?
Yes. If, for example, if tomorrow you stopped 70 or 80% of the irrigation in Central Asia or in the basin of the Aral Sea, you could bring the sea back. It would take a number of decades, but it's possible.
Mm.
So it can be brought back. The problem is that irrigated agriculture is still the basis of the economy. In Uzbekistan, which takes most water, Turkmenistan, which takes second most, and it's very important in the other new states of Central Asia. So they couldn't do it overnight at all.
Yep.
It would take decades to change the economy, reduce water use.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because we always think of climate change and environmental damage being a harmful thing that we're creating for the environment, and it is. But in this case, we're actually talking about human security. We're talking about the livelihood and the security of the people who live in those areas and the people who are now used to irrigation and endless supply of water. Water was filtered off, was taken off from these two rivers to irrigate. Is that what happened?
Yeah, basically that's right, yeah.
Okay, so we're not talking about rechanging the course. We're actually just talking about a simple thing of stopping using the water for irrigation.
Yeah, or maybe starting using it more efficiently, losing less water.
Right, but right now, as Professor Micklin has said, that's off the board because these people depend on cotton, I believe, as a crop.
Yeah, I think we cannot expect that in the next years the situation with the irrigation may change significantly. But I agree with Philip, and I would like to also mention that actually this desiccation of the Aral Sea is not the first in the history. Mm-hmm. Actually, there were several other episodes of similar regressions of the Aral Sea. The latest was some in medieval ages, some 500 years ago. And then there was another one some 2,000 years ago. And then all of these regressions always followed by recovery of the sea.
But there's no recovery now on the cards?
Not for now, but I have no doubt that maybe in a few hundred years.
A few hundred years. Yeah. Okay. But then what about the other communities that we never hear about, the people who live or lived on the shores of the sea, who are no longer able to support themselves? There's no fish for them to catch. Mm-hmm. Professor Micklin.
Actually, the fishery, at least in the northern part of the Aral Sea, has made quite a significant recovery because of the project that was implemented by the government of Kazakhstan and the World Bank, a project they built it in 2003 to 2005. It raised the level of the small Aral Sea a few meters.
That's the northern part.
It made a huge difference in the salinity, and the fishery has really come back there, but not anywhere near what it was.
Okay. So that seems to be, though, as far as it's going to go, isn't it? I mean, we're not going to get a widespread recovery of the whole area. We may see implementation of this international plan to preserve a part of the Northern Sea, and is only a part. I mean, I looked at the maps, and you talk about Israeli and Palestinian, you know, the way that the Palestinian territory has shrunk over the years. That's nothing compared to what's happened to the Aral Sea, is it?
Yeah, that's right. I think the realistic approach now is regional, so we may implement some approaches to mitigate the consequences of the desiccation in some individual areas or parts of the lake.
Okay, that's really interesting. Let's take a short break here.
Echo Plus.
Welcome back to Echo Plus program. Today we're discussing the cataclysmic fate of the Aral Sea. Joining me is Professor Peter Zavyalov, Deputy Director of the Institute of Oceanology at the Russian Academy of Sciences, and Philip Micklin, retired professor from the Department of Geography at Western Michigan University. Now, we've been talking about the general situation. For one, I'm fascinated in the cause of this. You mentioned that 50 years ago, we're talking about the Soviet Union. And I suppose one reason why it's difficult to take action on this huge sea, which is basically used to be four times the size of Wales, is because we're talking about two different countries. The territory is spread across two different countries. And furthermore, to even make it even more complicated, the country that once dominated that area no longer exists.
Yeah, that's right.
Peter?
Well, today's Aral Sea belongs to two newly independent states,
yep,
which are Kazakhstan in the north and Uzbekistan in the south.
Okay, so basically, to make this fantastic project like the dam happen, Professor Micklin, could you please tell us again, how did that happen? Do you say the World Bank came in? I mean, which international bodies stepped in and made this happen?
Well, after the collapse of the Soviet Union at the end of 1991, you had the new independent states of Central Asia.
Yep.
The World Bank became deeply involved, and they drew up an ambitious and complicated plan along with the governments, the basin governments, and then they started to implement this plan. One part of it was to try to partially rehabilitate the small Aral Sea in the north.
Yep.
And naturally, at the end of the 1980s, the North Aral Sea separated from the Southern Aral Sea. So it was a matter of simply building a dike and putting a dam to release water into it so they could control the level. And they did that over about a three-year period, 2002 to 2005, at a cost of about $85 million U.S. dollars.
Right.
And the project so far has been very successful, and in fact, the government of Kazakhstan is planning a second stage of it to increase the area of the small Aral Sea. There are two competing plans. I won't go into them. But the government apparently is very serious about proceeding with the second stage of the project.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely fascinating. So what's happening is that the world as a community is coming in and using these international bodies. Some of us relate to these organizations in different ways, but in this particular case, it seems to be useful. They're doing something good. I'd just like to question you more perhaps on the effects of this on local populations. I read that the region has the highest infant mortality rate in all the areas of the former USSR. Chronic bronchitis increased by 3,000%, arthritis 6,000%, and so on. These sound to me like very scaremonger type figures, but I'm sure there's some truth in there. Is this a problem?
Well, I'm not an expert in medicine and human health, but yes, the area around the Aral Sea in the south in Karakol, Pakistan, had very high rates of infant mortality. And I guess that was also true in the Aralsk Oblast, the region around the city or the town of Aralsk in the north. There's been quite a bit of study done on it. I am not really aware of what has happened to the disease rates in recent years, but they used to be very, very high. It was a result, a combination of things, poor medical care, poor drinking water and things like that. Mm. But there were major efforts by the governments of Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan to improve the situation, and there were a number of international projects also that worked on that. But I guess it still does remain a problem. Other things I might mention in my list of questions, you said chronic bronchitis. One thing that is making that worse are these salt dust storms that arise from the dry bottom. Those are becoming an increasing problem, blowing salt and dust.
Professor Vianov?
Yeah, I fully agree. I am not a medical expert as well. But as far as I know, the situation is improving now a little bit, but still that's a serious problem. And salt and dust storms that Philip mentioned are indeed a threat for the health of the local population, as well as the salinization of potable water, of groundwater.
So it seems to be a problem that's been left over from the days of the Soviet Union that's been exacerbated by the fact that the problem lies over the territory of two newly independent countries. And they don't cooperate with each other unless they have to. In comes the World Bank. I presume the World Health Organization also plays a significant role here. And I think in this case, we have to say that, okay, well, thank you guys. Thank you for the fact that there are large international organizations, which we are still members of, I believe.
Yeah, that's for sure.
There are regional organizations, the International Fund for the Aral Sea, which is a cooperative body that involves all five nations of Central Asia. And, I mean, I don't want to diminish the work they've done. They've done a lot of good work. And my own view is that the International Fund for the Aral Sea and the Interstate Water Management Committee has really done a pretty good job of trying to prevent conflicts over water between the states of Central Asia.
Right, because water is now the name of the game, isn't it? I mean, water is the new gold. Actually, that's not a good comparison. A better comparison would be water is the new black oil.
Yeah, in this case, that's true.
Yeah, although Kazakhstan's pretty rich in the latter.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Fascinating talking to both of you, and I think it's been interesting hearing about the fate of this unknown vast territory, which we only find out about when journalists make a sensational report of it. But it's a problem that's going to be there for a long time, probably the rest of our lives and the lives of our children, possibly their children, until perhaps the day comes when those two rivers will be allowed to flow back into that basin, the lowest lying basin in that area. Thank you very much indeed. Professor Micklin, retired professor from Department of Geography at Western Michigan University, and Professor Peter Zavyalov, Deputy Director of the Institute of Oceanology at the Russian Academy of Sciences. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, listeners, for being with us. Tune in next week. Bye-bye.